One of the things that you may or may not know about me is that, like, I am a vain runner, okay? And so you can tell I'm a runner because I have one of these on me, okay? This is a Fitbit, and so it's a fitness watch. It, like, auto-magically picks up the signals from satellites and stuff, and so I can track exactly where I run when I'm running with it, and it tells me how fast I'm running and how far I've run, and it tracks my heart rate as I run and everything, right? Like, it does pretty amazing things. And so clearly I do that because I have one of these because I enjoy running. Now put your hand up if you enjoy running. Like, if you get out, you know, go for a run just for fun. Oh, I know Jules is getting into running actually. But like for a lot of you, right, like running is not particularly exciting. I enjoy running, so I can go knock out a 10K run whenever I want, right? And so, like, just kind of for fun, go and do a 10K run. Now, the issue with this is that, you know, like, really when it comes down to me being a vain runner, there is a sense with which the word vain actually has two meanings. So the first meaning is having or showing an excessively high opinion of one's ability, right? So there is a sense with which, when I'm running by myself, I have a very high opinion of my ability. I am quite a good runner, right? But the you guys have to be quiet. I'm just gonna the other part of it though is that I actually when I run, like, I actually produce very little results. So the reality is, like, I'll run up to 10K, but I don't actually have any desire to do more than that. I don't even have the desire to compete. I've only done the round the bridges once, and that's because my son wanted to do it with me. And so there, I've got friends. And some, you know, some of them, right, that go out and, like, knock out 40K before breakfast. And you're kind of going, like, well, what's with that? But then I've got this young guy that works with me at the moment, and he is a competitive runner. And so he almost sees there's no point in running if you're not going to run to win. And so he goes, runs the Rotorua Half Marathon, and he wins it, right? So he does 21 kilometers in just over an hour. So he runs at about 19 kilometers an hour. And so I run about 10 kilometers in an hour, and he runs about, he runs at 19 kilometers an hour. In fact, when we did the Around the Bridges, I did the 6K, he did the 12K, and he did the 12K faster than I did the 6K. And so, you know, just to make sure I have no ego when it comes to running completely, right? Like, and so there's a sense with which, while I'm like running and I'm a vain runner, there is also the sense in which I run in vain. Now, when it comes to my spiritual life, often it's exactly the same thing. So oftentimes in my spiritual life, I have this excessively high opinion of how well I'm doing, of my own ability, of my ability to actually live the life that God wants me to live. And then there's other times that I look around and I see everybody else and I have this vain opinion of it because it's like I feel like what I'm doing is useless and unproductive. And so today we're continuing in our journey in Galatians, and Paul actually uses the term running in vain. And so if you have a Bible, turn to Galatians chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible, somebody will bring you one, so that'd be cool. Just put your hand up if you don't have one. So as you know, we're currently going through the book of Galatians as a church, which is a letter to the church of Galatia. And so Paul has been writing to this church, really setting out real compelling reasons why they don't need to follow the law or to follow traditions and customs like food and circumcision. And really what we're in the middle of, what Dave started reading last week, is we're in the middle of what's like a mini autobiography. You know, so a biography is a story of somebody's life, and an autobiography is a story where you're telling your own story of your life. And so Paul began last week with what Dave was covering, and he started talking about how, you know, he was converted on the road to Damascus, that he went into Arabia and he went to Damascus, and then he took his first trip to Jerusalem to meet Peter and kind of hear Peter's take on the world. And so we pick up in chapter 2 in verse 1, and it says this: 14 years later, I went up again to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas, and I took Titus along also. So 14 years after he had that meeting with Peter, 14 years afterwards, you know, which is quite a long time for a young people and not very old for older people, but long for older people. But, you know, like, it's 14 years is quite a period of time that he was away. So 14 years later, and you read about this in Acts 15, and you don't have to turn there, I'll read it for you. It says, some men came down from Judea to Antioch. So they were actually in this city called Antioch, right, which is about 800 kilometers away from Jerusalem. So some men came down to Antioch and were teaching, brothers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved. So these guys turn up and they're saying, you can't be saved unless you're circumcised. This brought Paul and Barnabas into sharp dispute and debate with them. So Paul and Barnabas were appointed along with some other believers to go up to Jerusalem to see the apostles and elders and to raise the question. And so Paul and Barnabas, and as we find out from Galatians 2, Titus, they set up on this journey. So this is kind of, I may have said it already, but it's like walking from Whangarei, you know, which some people here know where Whangarei is all too well, all the way to Wellington, right? And so that's the distance. So that's quite a walk, right, like from Whangarei to Wellington. And so they set off on this 18-day journey. I don't think I could walk it in 18 days. But like for them, it took about an 18-day journey. So they've got this issue going on that is so significant that they're getting sent to the apostles to go and sort it out with them. And they're on this 18-day journey. And so Barnabas comes along with them. And now Barnabas is the guy that really, when Paul first went into ministry, Barnabas was the guy that like took Paul on board and went out on his first ministry trip with him. Barnabas was a Christian well before Paul, and Barnabas was obedient to God. In fact, Barnabas's name means son of encouragement, right? So he's just this incredibly encouraging guy. And so he encouraged Paul. And through the book of Acts, it actually went Barnabas and Paul, whenever it refers to them, it goes Barnabas and Paul, Barnabas and Paul, Barnabas and Paul. And there's a point in the book in Acts where it becomes Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas. And so like that, ultimately, Barnabas had taken him under his wing selflessly, and then Paul had risen up to be the leader in the churches. But Barnabas was also a Jew, so that means that Barnabas was circumcised, right? And so he sets off on this journey, and they're going down to have this discussion. The other person that they take is a young guy called Titus. Now, Paul calls Titus like his true child or in the common faith, so it's like he's taking him on as his son. Right? Like, he's treating him like a son. He's a son in the faith. He's not actually his son. Now, Titus is not a Jew. Titus is not circumcised. So Titus is doing this 18-day walk to Jerusalem as well to decide whether or not you have to be circumcised to be saved. Not a very fun journey for Titus, right? Like, the potential risk there is quite high for him. But that's what's happening. And so they take this 18-day walk, and it's quite possible that some of the other people from the other faction and that actually also took that walk down there to kind of give their say. And we pick up in Galatians 2:2, and he says, I went in response to a revelation set before them the gospel that I preached among the Gentiles. I did this privately to those who seemed to be leaders, for fear that I was running or had run my race in vain. It's interesting, isn't it? Like, Paul grew up as a Pharisee. So that means that by the age of 11, he would have memorized the entire first five books of the Bible at least. You know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. He would have memorized them. Right, so to say that he knew the law was pretty impressive, right? So he was a Pharisee of Pharisees. And in fact, Ephesians says that he was circumcised on the eighth day, that he was from the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. In regard to the law, a Pharisee, as for zeal, persecuting the church, and for legalistic righteousness, he was faultless. So like he knew the law like nothing else. And yet, when he came to know Christ, he realized that you could not work your way towards God. He realized that it was all about God and all about Jesus. And so he's there, and he grabs a small number of believers together. rather than doing it in the synagogue or anything like that. He gets a small group of believers together and he does it in private. And he basically tells them the gospel that he's been sharing. And he has fear. I mean, what if he was wrong? What if they actually, the guys that knew Jesus, like Peter and John and James, actually disagreed with him? What if the message that he was preaching actually was a message of Jesus and the law? What if his ego was getting in the way and he was just being really, you know, debating it without actually seeking God? What if like his words had been empty and foolish and devoid of truth, which is what the Greek meaning of the word vain is? And so he has this fear, but he also has this certainty. And so he sets before them the gospel that he'd been preaching. And then it says, not even Titus, who was with me, was compelled to be circumcised, even though he was a Greek. I bet you Titus was happy about that, right? Like the walk home would have been a lot more comfortable. This matter arose because some false brothers had infiltrated our ranks to spy on our freedom that we have in Christ Jesus and to make us slaves. But verse 5 is like critical. We did not give in to them for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might remain in you. They did not give in to them for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might remain in you. Did you know this is probably one of the biggest, most defining moments for the early church? If this had gone the other way, we would now be, as Christians, obeying the law and trying to have Christ. And yet, like, he didn't give in to them for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might remain in you. And the outcome's brilliant. In verse 9, Peter and James and John, who were reputed to be the pillars of the church, and they were because they were the guys that were standing with Jesus at the Transfiguration, like, gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship. And they recognized the grace given to me, and they agreed that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the Jews. And they asked that all we should continue to remember is the poor, the very thing that I was eager to do. Now, you would think that that would be the end of it. You know, so they had this big powwow in Jerusalem, all the apostles together, flesh it out and go like, nah, that's it, it's done, right? Like, all you've got to do is have faith. You don't have to add the law. And yet sometime later, Peter comes to Antioch. And he comes up to Antioch, and at first when he gets there, I mean, it would be cool to have the apostle Peter come in, right? Like, rock into Antioch and hang out with you guys and all that kind of stuff. And so at first when he gets to Antioch, he's like hanging out with all of his Gentile friends, right? So imagine you guys are all my Gentile friends and we're hanging out together and I'm having breakfast and dinner with you and all those sorts of things. And, you know, like, I'm probably even eating pork, which you weren't allowed to do in the Old Testament, right? But you are now. So I can have bacon and eggs for breakfast, which is pretty cool, right? Like, so, and so I'm hanging out with my Gentile friends. And then some members of, or disciples of James turn up. We'll call them Team James. And they turn up. And they start basically getting Peter to draw back from his relationship with the Gentiles. And so Peter comes over here and he starts hanging out, like, with his Jewish friends. And he just starts eating Jewish food with them. And he stops having much to do, to the point that even Barnabas, the son of encouragement, to the point that he was joined him in there and was joined with him in the hypocrisy. Imagine what it would have been like if you were to like sit here and you were Peter and you were sitting here, right? And you were like hanging out with your Jewish mates. Imagine what it would have been like if Paul was to come and actually have a chat to him and like speak to him the way that he does in Galatians 2.
Peter. Has anyone seen Peter? There you are. Peter, what are you doing? You know that we have no right, no advantage of birth over the non-Jewish sinners. We know very well that we are not set right with God by rule-keeping, but only through a personal faith in Jesus Christ. How do we know? Peter, we tried it. We had the best system of rules this world has ever seen. And it didn't work. And we were convinced that no human being could please God by self-improvement. We believed in Jesus as the Messiah, so that we might be set right before God by trusting in the Messiah and not by trying to be good. Some of you notice that we're not yet perfect. No surprise, right? And are you ready to make the accusation that since people like me, who go through Christ in order to get right with God, aren't perfect and sin-free? That Christ must therefore be an accessory to sin? You know that accusation is stupid. Peter, if I was trying to be good, I'd be rebuilding that same barn that I tore down. I would be acting as a fake. What actually took place is this. I tried keeping the rules. I worked my head off to please God, and it didn't work. So I quit being a law man so that I could be God's man. Christ's life showed me how and enabled me to do it. I identified myself completely with him. Indeed, I have been crucified with my Christ. My ego is no longer central. It is no longer important that I appear righteous before you or have your good opinion. I am no longer driven to impress God because Christ lives in me. The life you see me living is not mine, but it is lived by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me, and I will not go back on that. Peter, is it not clear to you to go back to that old rule-keeping, peer-pleasing religion would be an abandonment of everything personal and free in my relationship with God? If a living relationship with God could come by rule-keeping, then Christ died for nothing.
I asked Liam to kind of like give that emotional plea, right, so that you could understand it. And what he did then was actually read from the Message. And so, and one of the things that we miss when we look at this passage in Galatians is that from verse 14 right to the end of chapter 2 is in speech marks. So it's actually the whole thing that Paul delivered to Peter. And so when Paul goes like, is it not clear to you that to go back to the old rule-keeping, peer-pleasing religion would be abandonment of everything personal and free in my relationship with God? I refuse to do that, to abandon God's grace. If living a relationship with God could come by rule-keeping, then Christ died for nothing. You see, it's a big thing for Peter. And we know a little bit about Peter's life. We know that he was the guy that denied Jesus, three times. We know that he was the guy that walked on water, right? Like, he's one of these guys that just seems to be mixed in the middle of everything. But he was also the first guy to receive a vision that God was going to take the gospel to the Gentiles. He was the first Jew to eat with the Gentiles before Paul even came on the scene. And he was in that meeting where they agreed, like 100%, that you don't need the law and anything, you just need Jesus. And yet he got caught up in it. And the issue is this. The pressure to be religious is relentless. It was relentless for them. And in many ways, it's relentless for us today. We actually, as human beings, like rules. We like laws. Our laws and countries continue to grow and grow and grow. And sometimes there's some rules that we disagree with and we don't particularly like it. But we actually like the fact that everyone gets to drive on the same side of the road and, all those sorts of things. We actually like rules. And we get frustrated when people don't follow the rules that we like, right? And so the pressure for us still today is that we actually try to impose rules on people. And the pressure to be religious is relentless. So you can see from Paul's autobiography that he was passionate and determined that the Gentiles in Galatia did not need to follow the law or its traditions, but it was all about freedom. And with that in mind, I thought, well, maybe we should have a look at what does freedom look like? Because we're talking a lot in this series about freedom. You know, does that mean that we just get to go and sin the whole time? What does that look like? How does God work in us if we don't have to obey rules, right? If you pick up your Bibles again and go to chapter 2, verse 19, I just want to read these in the NIV version, which some of you will be a little bit more familiar with. And verse 19 says, "For through the law I died to the law so that I might live for God. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. I do not set aside the grace of God. For if righteousness could be gained through the law, Christ died for nothing." Through the law, he talks about. Like he's going, I died to the law, but because of the law, I died to the law. And so does this mean that like the Ten Commandments are null and void? That, you know, we don't have to not commit murder or not, you know, or we can go off, whatever am I trying to say? Saying it the wrong way around, double negatives. But the like that we can go off and murder or have adultery or whatever. We know that Jesus actually amped it up a level, right? Like Jesus said, instead of like, you should not commit murder, Jesus said that if you hate somebody, you've committed murder in your heart. He said, do not commit adultery in the law. Jesus said, if you look lustfully at somebody, you've committed adultery in your heart. I mean, this was the standard of the law, and Jesus took it to there. He made it impossible to live up to. And so the law is still there, and it's still relevant, but ultimately we don't have to try and work to fulfill the law. We just have to have faith in Jesus. Paul says, I've been crucified with Christ. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. I live in the life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God. Okay, I'm going to get you to click your fingers. Can you click your fingers? I'm going to have to do it real loud because there's not that many people. Okay, I need you to do it all at the same time. Ready? One, two, three, go. Okay, that's good. So here's the questions. You ready? First question is, if you know this to be true, then click your fingers, okay? Do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe that he has forgiven you? Do you struggle with sin? Do you feel the pressure to behave certain ways? Are there some days, if you're honest, that you struggle, that you struggle to no longer live? Are there some days, just because the boy's distracting me again, are there some days, if you're honest, that you struggle to say it is no longer I that lives, but Christ that lives in me? We're all like that, right? And for me, like, I've been thinking about this whole vein running from a spiritual perspective. I've been thinking about, like, you know, the times that I have this excessively high opinion of myself. That I think that I have to work to get rid of some sin habit, or that I think that I have to work to be a good dad, or to whatever else it might be, or to be a good elder, right? Like, I feel like there's days that, like, it's all about me, that it's in vain, that it's an excessively high opinion of how well I'm doing. There are days that I think I'm doing a really good job of it, but the problem is it's like days that I think I'm doing a really good job of it. And then there are other days where I really feel like what I'm doing as a Christian and in my spiritual life produces little or no results. There are days that I look at the lives of other people and think that they're way better than me, that they achieve more than me. And yet Paul is saying that the whole thing is pinned on faith. If Christ is to live fully in us, it requires faith. And the more faith that we have, the easier it becomes. In fact, like Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 says this. It says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. And because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Like, it doesn't say that he rewards those who obey his commandments. He rewards those who earnestly seek him. And in fact, like, beginning of Hebrews says, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. And I've been realizing, like, the times that I really struggle, or I start living my spiritual life in vain, are the times that I take my eyes off Jesus. Are the times that I stop having faith in him, that I stop putting my hope in him, that I start trying to, like, work so that my kids will come to know Christians and become Christians instead of putting my hope in Jesus that will happen. That I start working on things myself instead of putting my hope in Jesus to work on me. Faith is being sure of what we hope for. You know, we have this hope that Jesus is coming back again. We have hope because it's happening. We have hope that we get to spend eternity with him. And then, like, being certain of what we do not see. We are certain that Jesus walked on this earth. We are certain that he rose again from the dead. We're certain that he's returning. We're certain that our salvation is, like, locked up completely. We're certain that we're forgiven. And so for us to start getting to that point where we feel like it is Christ that lives in us, it's not about actually stopping and trying to do all these actions and do these things and tick off the list or come to church. It's about focusing solely on him and trying to build your faith. The more we build our faith in him, the more Christ lives in us. The more we can ultimately say, I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. And the interesting thing that Paul goes on to say in verse 21, he says, I do not set aside the grace of God. For if righteousness could be gained through the law, Christ died for nothing. Does that mean that God does not want you to become righteous? Doesn't, right? Like, he actually wants to work in you. He wants you to become more righteous. He wants you to become more godly. He wants you to be free from some of the burden of sins that you've carried in the past. But he doesn't want you to do that. He wants to do that in you. I loved Titus. You know, I was talking about that young guy Titus that went with him and, you know, had a narrow escape and all that sort of stuff. But, like, Paul wrote to him in a book that, funnily enough, is called Titus. And so, like, you can go to Titus 2.11, but I love that it says in there, like, now, 2.11 says, for the grace of God appeared, bringing salvation to all men. Like, he's talking to this young guy who's pastoring Gentile churches, and he's saying, the grace of God appeared, bringing salvation to all men. And we know that, right? Like, we know that it's about God's grace that brings us salvation. But God's grace does something more than that. It teaches us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires and to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in this present age. As we put our faith in Jesus, as we just focus on doing that, his grace, through Christ living inside of you, will teach you to say no to ungodliness and worldly desires and to live sensibly and righteously and godly in this present age, while we look for the blessed hope and the appearing of our and the glory of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify for himself a people for his own possession, zealous to do what's good. It all comes through grace. It doesn't come from our actions. Only thing that we can do is to continually focus and put our faith in him. You see, freedom's goal is not sin. Freedom's goal is that our faith in God and in Jesus would increase. Not because we're trying to please people, or not because we're trying to follow the law, or even trying to please God, but purely because we're trying to have a relationship with him so that the Spirit of God might dwell in you. I know, like, to conclude that, like, most of you don't want to live your Christian life in vain. You don't want to run that race in vain. And one of the challenges that we've got as people is that when we try to do it ourselves, we start actually running in vain. We start losing fact to the point that it's all about a relationship with Jesus. Some of you here will look back at your last week or your last month or whatever it might be, and you'll see that Christ is growing in you. You'll actually feel like, wow, I'm looking back and I'm going like, Christ is becoming more alive in me. And some of you are going to look back over the last week or last month or the last 6 months and see that Christ is not actually living in you. He's starting to die in you. And so this morning, the music team are going to come now, but we're going to take communion. And the reason we're taking communion today is so that we can just focus in again on who Jesus is. That we can again just come back and go like, Jesus, with his body, he actually walked on this earth. Historical fact. That God walked on this earth and died and rose again. And that is an incredible thing. And that one action of him dying and rising again means that we are no longer to conform to the rules and to the laws of old, but that it's all through faith in Jesus.